Well, hello everyone, and welcome once again. I'm here with Todd Lewis, Praise of Folly, who runs an excellent channel here and whose takes we've been enjoying all week. Today, we're going to elaborate on some of the things we were talking about yesterday. We talked about NRX and Yarving yesterday. Today, Todd wants to talk about the fetishization of authoritarianism and power for its own sake that you see on some parts of the online right. Some people have accused me of this, ladies and gentlemen, although I think those criticisms are misplaced, as we'll get into. Before we get going, I will remind people, Foundations of Shakespeare, buy it now. This is an excellent edition. I really love the color maps. You can get it 50% off if you have if you own the course, Foundations of Shakespeare, and there's 25% off that course right now, as there are 25% off all courses at the Academic Agency all through January. So we're going to hear this advert. Todd, you must be sick of hearing this advert because we're recording all these on the same day. But when we come back, we're going to talk about authoritarianism.
Sure. Sure, 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 sure. And so, sure.
Sure, Dan.
Can you command a comma like Joseph Conrad?
Sure, sure, sure,
sure, sure, sure, sure, Dan.
Are you magnificent in your mastery of marginalism like Murray Rothbard?
Sure.
Sure, Dan.
Are you legendary in your logical leveling of lamentable loquacity?
Sure.
Sure, Dan.
Come on down to the January sale at the Academic Agency. Promo code SHORJAN for 25% off. All this January, I got more courses than the Queen had horses.
Sure, Dan.
I got better rates than Andrew Tate's had mates.
Sure, Dan.
I got better deals than Lizzo's had meals.
Sure.
Sure, Dan.
And so, sure, 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 and so, sure, sure, sure.
Trust me, that is better with the music. Last week, I accidentally put it out without the music on. I have two files. One of them is called, they're both called shorjan.mp4 in different folders. And I accidentally put the original, like, pre-music version on, and there were a lot of people complaining that their favorite Shore Jam beat was not on. So there we are. As horrible as it is to suffer three times in one day, you know, there are even worse versions of it. Okay, so Todd, authoritarian power. Let's talk about it. What is the problem and who do you see fetishizing this online?
Yeah, so I'll just open up with what I consider the basics of political thought, right? Aristotle gives us the three categorizations, rule the one, the few, the many, and then you can break those down into the rule for the sake of the greater good, the virtuous forms, and then those for selfish gain, the vicious forms. And then you could say the fourth element would then be the mixed regime of the Republic, which is exemplified in Rome, which mix all three together. Now, all the virtuous forms participate in the rule of law, the idea that you have laws and that the leader cannot just tear those laws up and do what he wants. And so that would be a tyranny. The rule of the one would be a tyranny in an Aristotelian definition. Now, the point then is to move beyond that. If we look at a state apparatus, a state system, prior to Alexander the Great, there is no imperial autocratic state system anywhere in Europe. It doesn't exist. It comes out of Persia, which in turn inherits it from the Egyptians and Babylonians. And then that gets transmitted into the European bloodstream by Alexander. And I think that this is something that needs to be pointed out for a couple of reasons. One, there's a lot of negative externalities that are tied to authoritarian regimes. Also, that this, if you want to position yourself as some sort of a right-wing defender of Europe or the West, and then you wrap yourself in the garments of this kind of thing, you know, the Imperium, thing like Francis Parker Yaki, these ideas are coming into Europe from the outside. And that's something that I don't believe aware of, but I think though that this creates a narrative problem because, well, okay, you can't then on the one hand say, oh, you know, the Chinese are X because, you know, yeah, they have authoritarian regimes though. And, but then you're going to adopt all of the trappings of that kind of political system. Why would you do that? Because you just said that these people are, you know, inferior to you in some way. And I think if you believe that, then you'd certainly have to believe in the form of government they choose to live under. And so really it's what I call the Oriental conquest of the West, right? You have this Oriental way of thinking of delegating all your power to the top, to have the Son of Heaven character. And it's like, that's just not European. Now, someone might say, well, we have had such institutions in Europe. Yes. But we have liberal regimes now. I mean, and they don't come from other countries. They came from within Europe, and many on the right oppose those as problematic, right? Just because I could point to the fact and say, well, FDR was a liberal in the United States and, or, you know, Gladstone in the 19th century in the UK, isn't going to be an argument in favor of endorsing these policies. But if somebody says, well, Charles V was emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, therefore, ... well, that doesn't follow either. Especially since these structures of government are not representative of the authentic Western tradition. The authentic Western tradition is in all the non-urban civilizations, so Gauls, Germans, or, you know, ancient Germans, Slavs, they all had direct democracies. The Vetch, the Folkmoot, the Althing are all direct democracies. Athens was a direct democracy. Sparta and Rome were mixed constitutions. And so in the ancient world, you know, this is where it started. This was the unique Western contribution. So if you reject that, how are you Western?
Well, I would say I'm in a pretty good place to try to start answering these, being half Persian as I am. First thing is that I feel duty bound to defend Cyrus the Great here. I mean, are you saying this guy, Cyrus the Great, was a tyrant and an autocrat? Because when I look at world history, he's one of the more judicious kings ever. And the dominant trait of Cyrus in history is fairness, is that he treated the subject peoples with such great fairness that he had kingdoms flip to be want to be part of Persia. I've often joked, you know, you've played Civilization before, you know, you can get the yes. culture, right?
Yep.
Cyrus, if you actually read the history of Persia, Cyrus gets a lot of culture flips from, right, you know, rival kings just coming and saying, look, I actually want to come under the King of Kings without a sword being lifted, okay? But one of the reasons that this was enabled is because the Persian Empire had the satrapy system where they devolved power back down, and the Persian Empire was kind of a small layer on top, okay? The other thing I want to mention is that the so-called Cyrus Scrolls, again, if you go back to playing your Sid Meier's Civilization, that is the unlocking of the tech of the code of laws, i.e., you know, if you're within the boundaries of the empire, you come under the law, the imperial law, which then if somebody's mistreated, there's something to appeal up to. Okay. And this has, you know, direct applications in all sorts of historical examples that you can think of. Now, you could argue that the Persian Empire actually had its own, it had its golden moment with Cyrus. But as per Machiavelli, you start with a wise king and then it starts to devolve and you get shitheads down the line type thing. You could argue that subsequent King of Kings did become more tyrannical. They became more racist, I guess you'd put it that way, or supremacist in their doctrine. And this, you could argue, is it was the beginning of the end for the Persians. And then when Alexander, this is just my own understanding, you know, my cursory understanding of ancient history, when Alexander, you know, won, Alexander the Great, he actually looked back to Cyrus and then tried to adopt some of those things that worked. But then subsequently, you've got the, what do they call it, the Seleucids? Is that how you say it?
Seleucids.
Yeah, the Seleucids. They actually then, I mean, I talked all about this in my recent series. Well, it's about 6 months old now, but where I talked about racial supremacism as a problem, as a doctrine. The Greeks under that empire did away again with the devolution and the satrapy system and had this idea where the ruling class had to be Greek. You actually had to be Greek to, you know, and therefore it is these people are on top. And then, of course, once you have that, you get revolts over. You actually do away with the fairness of the code of laws and the kind of wise judicial Cyrus system. Okay, so I would kind of quibble with the characterization of the Persian Empire as being kind of totally authoritarian or tyrannical. In many ways, it was kind of the first, or one of the first, kind of multicultural societies, you could put it that way. But it just had this kind of way of dealing with it, where it devolved power down into satrapies. Obviously, there was no question of democracy. So that's the first thing I'd say. The second thing I'd query is, when you talk about direct democracy, are you talking about a system where every single person, men and women and people from all walks of life, could vote? Or are you talking about, you know, property owning classes voting, or, you know, just soldiers being able to vote or something? Like, was there some special thing? Like, in some places I seem to remember you had to own an armor or own a horse in order to have a vote. Or was this literally one man, one woman, one vote?
So, yeah, there's a few things here. I would say that the distinction that needs to be made between, say, the king, the virtuous example of rule, the one that Aristotle points to, and the tyrant, which was often by the Greeks associated with the Persians or with other regimes from that part of the Middle East, is that a king defends his realm by recruiting soldiers from his own ethnos. An imperial state does not do that by definition, because all of its soldiers come from all over the empire. And that then creates this pressure within that imperial military can then oppress the subject populations, because you just keep mixing them around and they have no built-in loyalty. And so if you argue, like, say, Yaki does, that imperium is going to protect your ethnos, no, it literally won't. By definition, an empire is multicultural. It's multi-ethnic. It's multiracial. So by definition, you're not going to preserve your own ethnic group. In fact, all the major revolutionaries in Europe in the 19th century were anti-monarchists because they wanted Italian nationalism, right? Eventually, monarchies were asserted, but the very first one was the French Revolution, and they wanted to get away with the monarchy. So second of all, with Cyrus, he's king of a unified Persian state. And I would argue that that was sort of like a high watermark. And then once the Persian Empire absorbed all of these other peoples, the logic of that political system starts to unfold in ways that, for example, Herodotus reports that in the invasion of Greece, there was one satrap who didn't want to cooperate fully with Cyrus. So Cyrus cuts his son in half and marches an army right through. As to democracy, in the ancient world, when I say direct democracy, I don't mean women voting, and I don't mean, you know, non-members of the clan or tribe or polis voting, but that of those classes, of those elements that were eligible to vote, in these non-urban societies, the Celts, the Germans, and the Slavs, all men capable of bearing arms could vote, or all men capable of participating in that tribal life. Athens is a urban society that has direct democracy amongst its citizens. And now, you know, something more like property is going to be considered, because property in the Greek and Roman sense is going to be more spelled out than in these, you know, pre or non-urban societies. And then Rome does work on including other people into its political system. That's one, that was what made it a genius political system in antiquity. And the other thing too, these are two things now. There's a kind of like chud take that, oh, well, empire means big armies led by a general, which means we're going to just, you know, stomp the opposition to our people, to the West, to Europe, to whatever. It turns out that there's this pressure that actually hurts military performance, whether it's Justinian and Belisarius, or where he's afraid that he might raise an army to march on, you know, Constantinople, whether it's the way Suvorov is treated by the czars at the time, whether it was Stalin's purge of Tukhachevsky. Competent military officials are hamstrung, arrested, or executed by these regimes because they fear their power. And so if you believe in this, you know, need for robust national defense or a war against the enemies of Europe, you're not setting yourself up with the right kind of leadership class. Let's look at Rome versus the Hellenistic monarchies. Rome just beats all of them because, you know, these guys don't have skin in the game, right? That when Persia invaded Greece, the Greeks were free men and they fought as free men to defend their homes and their way of life. Many of the Persian soldiers, they didn't really want to be there. And so, you know, they didn't put in 110% because why? I'm only here because I got conscripted, right? So there's a sense in which they mistake the big battalions for actual value.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the Persians were playing away, if you want to put it that way. The Greeks were at home.
Yes.
Initially, at the very least, until... interesting. I want to get back to this idea of authoritarian, though, because... you know, as author of Populist Illusion, you know, I think democracy everywhere and always is an illusion, as I've said in print and I've talked about many times. And this triangle on the front is basically the structure of every system you can imagine. And the real thesis of this book and the real kind of takeaway from elite theory is that what you call the system, i.e. if you call it monarchy, if you call it democracy, if you call it republic, if you call it dictatorship, if you call it feudalism, doesn't matter what, it's, you can't really get away from this structure of things, i.e. the ruling class being the small pin on the head of the triangle. There's also a non-ruling elite as well, or a non-governing elite, intellectuals, priests, whatever you want to call it, but some dealers in discourse, you might call them, okay, as well as bureaucrats and, you know, the guy to collect the taxes and so on, various other technicians who help the state, okay? And then below that, this wide base of the triangle is the ruled many. And the whole point of this book is to say, like, look, it doesn't really matter what you call your system. You can say you're a liberal democracy, or you can say you're a monarchy, or you can say you're an empire, or you can say you're this or that. But realistically, whoever ends up in charge you're still going to end up with reproducing the functions of this triangle here. Okay. Now, how does what you're saying mesh with, contradict, or agree with what I'm saying here? To me, it doesn't make any sense, because I don't really see, like, when I look at the Islamic Republic in Iran, which I know pretty well, okay, I see the Ayatollah at the top, and then I see the facade of a democracy underneath with a parliament and various other people and a president who gets elected and this party and that party. But almost everybody in Iran knows that the guy who's the president can call himself a hardliner, a conservative, a reformer, right? But ultimately, this fucker's still in charge. And when I look at the British system, as I talked about before many times, you can say, well, there's the Tory party, there's Reform, there's Labour, right? You can put this person in charge or that person in charge. But when I look at the system, in exactly the same way, this fucker is still in charge. Doesn't matter who you vote for, because there's a permanent deep state. Now, to most people looking, they'd say, well, Iran's authoritarian regime and Britain is a liberal democracy. I say, actually, they're functionally identical in almost every respect. Maybe the Iranian government is more likely to round you up and shoot you in the head. Maybe. But increasingly, I mean, we've seen the British government, in terms of arresting political dissidents and so on, I mean, you know, for tweets and speech and things, it's up there. I mean, there's a lot of slop around that, but it's like, you could say, well, there's authoritarian elements in the British system, which has always done these sort of things. So what I'm saying is, when you look past all of the bullshit justifications for it, this one says I'm Islamic, this one says I'm a liberal democracy and feminist, you end up with the same thing. What are you saying, Todd? That's what I want to get to.
So yeah, there's a lot here. So let's start with in the classical and Western political doctrine, the idea is that the political system, whatever it is, right, ought to conform to the natural and moral law, you know, from nature and from divine sources, from custom, and be bound by those. The universal mark of the person that I'm talking about is someone who does not respect any of that. In Arrian's biography of Alexander, he mentions philosopher Callisthenes. He says, look, we Greeks, or Macedonians have kings, Greeks have many different political systems. We all have the rule of law. We can't have one man just arrest another man without a trial, without any of these things, and then just execute him. Or force him to do some service of obeisance, which is called proskynesis, which is an Asiatic concept. You, Alexander, try to bring that into our culture. That's one part of his critique, and that's just not what. So the power structure is, in one sense, being limited in what it can do. So, you know, in theory, there's a maximum amount of force any state could apply to any given person or problem. But in practice, there are reasons why it doesn't or can't do that. In an autocratic state, there are fewer impediments to that than in a non-autocratic state. And so that means, you know, you're not going to have, to contrary to the Soviet Union, jackboot on your face, like in the 80s, you know, which led to the color revolutions, versus whatever we have here in the United States. It's not great, but we don't have, you know, for example, the British were quartering soldiers in American homes, which was part of why we had the American Revolution, and it was included in the Constitution. They weren't going to be able to quarter soldiers in your home. So on the one hand, it's saying that we are erecting structures that will put pressure on the state apparatus to not apply maximal force all of the time, or it doesn't apply all of the force that it has all of the time. Yeah. The other thing is it's a kind of selection pressure, right? How are the rulers selected? So, and this is where Machiavelli comes in. He compares the Roman, because he loves the Roman Republic. It's his go-to example for everything. If you have monarchs, and he talks about this in The Prince and the Discourse on Livy, you have a trend. You have a few good ones at the start, you know, your Cyruses, right, your Dariuses. And then over time, there's this sort of like apathy and crippled quality that comes in. You see this with the Ottoman Empire as well. Very strong early sultans. And then they reach a terminal nosedive. Mm-hmm. He says in a republic, because you have more of a competition between elites, you can actually get better elites on a regular basis. Over time. So over time, a republic is going to have a higher quality level of elites because of competition between elites. And he points to Scipio in the Second Punic War. At the start of the war, he was a nobody, and Hannibal looked like he was going to win. But, you know, because of the nature of the Roman political system, they were able to select him and then put him in a position of authority to save the state. That would never, those kinds of things don't happen. As I said, autocratic regimes would have probably arrested or executed Scipio because he would have been seen as a threat. And then, you know, the outside threat of Hannibal then is triumphant. That's sort of like Alexander and the Persians. Alexander is, you know, the Hannibal of his day. He just bowls over the Persians. And, you know, they can't as easily draw within resources. They have human resources, but they're not efficiently using them. The Roman Republic efficiently used human resources better. And that's partly due to, you know, one, as I said, competition between elites. But then also, it's a way to get people to have skin in the game. Because, you know, if you are a tyrant and you make political decisions and you don't pay attention to what people are saying, you know, you might have a revolution on your hand tomorrow because you did something that just got the whole country up in arms. Whereas like in Greece and Rome, and then on a much smaller scale with like the Germanic and Celtic peoples, if you have some forum for which people can, who are citizens can participate in the system, you run the risk, you mitigate against the risk of catastrophic negative externalities to the actions you take. Because you're taking actions within a matrix that's been more clearly defined as to what you can expect will happen. There's this concept called blowback, where you take an action and then things happen that you didn't account for. Mm-hmm. One way of accounting for this is by pulling the room. And so those are the arguments that I would make.
All right. Well, where do I start with this? I mean, for the Machiavelli point, it's very difficult to look at, you know, the trajectory from Teddy Roosevelt to Donald Trump and say that is 100+ years of evolution and better leaders. I mean, it's kind of as far. I mean, obviously, that isn't necessarily the case, is it? And you would never point to the progression from Reagan to Bush Senior to Clinton to Bush Junior to Obama to Biden and Trump as a kind of evolutionary process where each leader is progressively better than the last one. I would argue that the Republic often throws up pretty shit leaders. Would you not agree with that?
No, I wouldn't for a few reasons. Let's look at David and Goliath, the Dutch versus the Spanish. How does this little tiny country, like about 3 million people, I think at the time, take on the Spanish Empire? This is the empire that was, you know, built by Charles V. Because, well, there were two things. The Spanish Empire was vastly overextended. That was a big problem. So that was on Spain's part. But Holland better utilized its human resources than the Spanish Empire did. I would also argue that Venice took out the Byzantine Empire and the Fourth Crusade. They played some, you know, mafia moves there. But I believe also Venice better utilized its human resources. Now, this is the elephant in the room. Okay, what about the last 200 years in the West? Ah, well, this is where some of your more leftist Marxist friends come in handy. This is all a mask that capital wears. This isn't really a democracy. It's just it's an oligarchy masquerading as a democracy. And so the last 200 years, during the bourgeois revolution, there was a confluence of two trends, right? The rising mercantile trend that was coming out of Italy and the Hanseatic League in the Middle Ages, which is where the Marxist critique is. And then there's also what I would argue the repressed tendencies of European self-government, which goes back to, you know, before there were organized states. And so those two are both pushing up at the same time and work together because they have a common enemy, the entrenched aristocratic elites. But they don't really align on the fundamental issues. The ancient Greek scholars would talk about how wealth corrupts these systems. And so what we're observing is an oligarchy masquerading as a democracy or a republic.
Wouldn't the simplest thing to be to say, though, democracy or quote-unquote liberal democracy is simply the system favored by merchants? When merchants are on top, they're going to make it a democracy because they can simply buy off the leaders. And that's basically where Mosca and Pareto and friends start. He says, look, you know, you don't get him elected. His friends got him elected. They buy column inches. They, you know, driven by the media, you know, direct. I mean, in American politics, it's the donor class, and so on. But you could say, well, whenever you get a rise of merchants, they're going to want to bring about this sort of smokescreen for their own power, right? Because it's you then get the illusion that you're picking people. But what you're saying is that's not proper democracy. Proper democracy is pre-Roman tribes doing a show of hands, something like this.
Well, yeah, in the European tradition, that is the original form. And then even when you have more complex, like mixed regimes, like Sparta and Rome, and then Athens don't attempt a direct democracy, Sparta knew that by bringing in wealth, that would destroy their mixed government. And eventually it did. But and by mixed government, I mean it has the elements of the rule of the one, the few, and the many. That's what, you know, Machiavelli would call a republic. So Rome and Sparta is two flagship examples. Rome also understood that wealth would corrupt the republic, but unlike Sparta, they didn't outlaw wealth. And eventually, you know, that leads to the crisis with Caesar and Pompey, you know, in the first century BC. And so I think what there's two different theories of representative government, which would include democracy, but it could also include republics. The classical tradition, which goes from, you know, Aristotle up to the founding fathers when they did the Federalist Papers, and then the more modern, progressive, far left, everybody gets a vote, mass democracy, urban democracy kind of angle. And I don't view those two as the same. I think that they come from two different intellectual streams. They make different claims about why these things are good or bad. And they, what the modern right does is it looks at that and says, well, that's not what we want. That's alien to what we are. And I'm like, okay, fine. I might even agree with you on that. But the idea of the rule of law and government, mixed government checks and balances, that's right there from the beginning. That's not coming from the woke left. That's not coming from liberals. And it's not coming out of the Near East. So the issue then is, for example, right, those on the right will laugh when say, like, North Korea says they're a democratic people's republic, or the Soviet Union was a republic. And yeah, but if you just flip the script, you can also laugh and say, well, look, these are just oligarchies masquerading as republics or democracies, in which case, you know, they're not. I mean, Rome was not, the non-urban societies that I mentioned were not commercial. And early on, Rome was less commercial, right? The commercialization of Rome is what brings down the republic. Initially, it's not really as commercial as it would end up. You know, Crassus being the richest man in the empire, the republic can do whatever he wants. Such a man didn't exist in, like, you know, 300.
I mean, probably my biggest comeback to all of this, Todd, would be, and I mean, there are some key people we haven't mentioned here that are influential on right-wing thought. De Maistre would be one. Carl Schmitt would be another one. I would actually argue Thomas Hobbes in the Western tradition is pretty important when it comes to this as well, because he makes the argument for absolute monarchy. But it all boils down to the same thing. And this may even relate back to the degeneration that you spotted in the Persian Empire. Remember, we talked about the Code of Laws and the Cyrus Scrolls and how there's a degeneration from him to more despotic leaders later on. What that regime and many other regimes, the Soviet regime included, and every other man-made structure that we can think of, come up against is, I would argue, the reality of executive power as outlined by Carl Schmitt, you know, the Schmittian exception. In fact, another person in the Western tradition who talks about this is David Hume. I don't know if you've come across Hume. He's famous for Hume's fork and various other things, but he was, again, kind of a liberal thinker, classical liberal. But Hume conducts these thought experiments. And he says, look, imagine there's some disaster, great flood comes, or, I don't know, widespread famine, or, I don't know, you name it, an invasion, whatever. "You know as well as I do," he says, "that the normal order of things, the normal code of laws, are suspended for those periods, those emergency periods, and we have to intervene in all sorts of ways." All right, and this was David Hume basically coming up against the limits of laissez-faire. You know, if you're properly into free market stuff, you come up against, well, what happens if there's a shortage of water? And most people want the government to intervene to say, well, look, people are dying of thirst here. We have to get water from there to there now. Okay. Whereas if you're a true doctrinaire free marketeer, you say, actually, you need the price signal to go up, and then the water manufacturers will get more water to you. You remember all these arguments, okay? And what Hume says is that in reality, you know, everybody knows that in those emergency situations, the normal order of things is suspended, including, pivotally, property rights. We may have to suspend even property rights in those emergency scenarios, okay? I mean, you can come up with your own ones, but I don't know. Let's say everybody has to evacuate an area, and somebody's like got a house in the way or whatever. You'd be like, right, we have to sweep that house away, otherwise all these people are going to die, right? So he's talking about these sorts of scenarios. What Carl Schmitt says many years later is that in the final analysis, all power takes on this form. That, yes, there is the normal code of laws for the normal plebs. There is the normal rules that we all have to follow. But when a state really wants to do something, all that goes out the window, right? And we've seen it so many times. I mean, pretty much every American war ever has emergency decrees issued by the president. The normal order of things is suspended. We saw it during the pandemic and COVID. We even saw it very recently, you know, international law, the international rules-based order, blah, blah, blah. They literally just went in and kidnapped Maduro. Raw Schmittian decisionism, I guess you'd call it. And once you see this is the true nature of power, and that the line separating doing that to the leaders following the code of laws or the constraints of the constitution or whatever other constraints people have come up with, because these things are constraints, they are checks and balances, they're designed in that way. What Schmitt is saying is that actually a lot of the time in the real world, these constraints are done away with all the time, and that if you're ever going to actually wield power properly, you have to step over them. Now, obviously, that sort of thinking did lead to Nazi Germany, admittedly, right? But you can see that basically all systems tend towards this. It's a very difficult thing to countervail. And all of the times that great changes come about is when leaders are prepared to wield that Schmittian decisionism. You know, I've talked about Tony Blair on numerous occasions. If you look at his actual actions within the British system, he was just prepared to do stuff nobody else was prepared to do. The normal order of things that was put in place by custom and convention, he just trampled all over them. So I guess my point is, a realist would say, yeah, it's a nice idea to have these checks and balances and constraints, but every system ultimately ends up tending towards absolutism, as per Schmitt, De Maistre, and you could even throw in Juvenal there, even though he was a liberal. The actual upshot of what he argues is that you get greater centralization of power all the time. So what's your comeback to all of that? Because that's what most well-read viewers of this will be thinking. So let's go.
Well, I mean, it kind of sounds like somebody saying, well, because eventually the government will put us in lockdown, let's just live under lockdown all the time. I don't want to live in a lockdown all the time. I think that's a bad idea. I would rather force the government to make that decision. Now, of course, this Schmittian concept of the exception, that the Romans knew this. That's why they had a dictator who they could then elect for a six-month period in an emergency to have a full political power to protract a military conflict. Now, the question then becomes, And I think this is a really important point to stress. Technology has caused the modern West and the world to change so rapidly that it allows elites to do things that no elites in the past could ever dream of even doing. And so part of this creates a bias of us living in this present age where this is possible, and we just kind of retroactively push it back throughout all of history, when it turns out that there are actually far more constraints than we often are willing to admit in these earlier regimes of both types that I'm talking about. And then also, if we look at the fact that every state has to be integrated with the technological society in order to be competitive on the world stage militarily, there is a homogenizing effect that occurs. So that whether, you know, C.S. Lewis talks about this in The Abolition of Man, whether you call yourself democracy, fascist, communist, you're all governed by this technocratic elite. And this technocratic elite is going to impose a uniform consistency on you between you and all the other regimes, because they are all doing the same thing, you know, inventing new ways to consolidate power and control and employ destructive weapons of war. And so it creates a homogenizing effect that didn't exist in a lot of the eras where classical republics were described. And so that creates a biased impression on many people's parts, because that's all they've known, right? And even for the last maybe 100 years, that's all we've known. In which case, it's like, yeah, we don't really think about how constrained even, say, you know, a Chinese emperor would have been. You know, for example, Xi, because he sits at the top of a state with a vast technological system, is vastly more powerful than any Chinese emperor and can do things that a Chinese emperor could never have dreamed of, even with complete power and control of the state. So that creates a bias in understanding. And then also, too, while if we look at politics, right, everything, at least everything physical, sits on physics, and physics describe, and one of the things that physics describes is thermodynamics, energy flows. While political states do have a tendency to centralize power into their own hands in order to become more powerful, thermodynamics kicks in and they collapse. Joseph Tainter says you have, you know, he describes collapse as moving from a high energy state to a low energy state. And so these high energy states of autocratic regimes are also unstable because you have to keep feeding energy into them. And as you mentioned in another episode we did, there's a bottleneck of decision-making if one man doesn't delegate power downward. So that creates even more pressure on the system. And that then makes it brittle and more vulnerable to collapse. And so while if you look at the perspective of physics, thermodynamics wins and your house of cards falls over.
Right. So are you arguing, I do need to be clear what exactly you're arguing. Are you arguing, and your point, by the way, of people reading kind of totalitarianism back into the past is, I mentioned Shakespeare at the start. My first book was on New Historicism, which was a school of American California-based critics, Steven Greenblatt and people like this. And they were frequently accused of reading Stalin back into the Tudor period, right? I.e., because the Tudors claimed for themselves divine right of kings and absolutism, that they imagined that the Tudor state functioned like the Soviet Union or like a modern totalitarian dictatorship. Whereas in reality, they just didn't have the capability, right? The average man in Tudor England under Henry VIII would have been vastly freer, quote unquote, in what he could say or do or get away with than somebody now, due to really basic things like surveillance cameras and, you know, like the inability of the state to spy on you, and the raw fact that every feudal lord, if he's not that nice to his men, or if the king is not that nice to his subjects and so on, has the possibility of ending up dead as well, Todd. Something that Mosca talks about. He says, like, look, you have to understand that the old feudal lord would have been able to sit down and have a pint with the peasantry who he lived with, because he had to look these people in the face. And this is something the elite theorists all talk about, how as you get the revolution of mass and scale, the elite class actually is distanced from the people to the point where nobody's talking about sitting down and having a pint with the civil servant who you never see, or Keir Starmer or someone like this. They feel distant from you, or, you know, Washington, D.C. is literally thousands of miles away from where most Americans are sitting, right? So there's a physical distance as well. So that is one thing, and I would grant you all of that. What I'm trying to understand is, are you actually suggesting that in the present circumstances that the American system as it stands now, or the British parliamentary system, could argue, is still preferable to something like, I don't know, Maduro's Venezuela, let's say, or China? I know a lot of rightists look to China, right? Some of our leaders, Blair, I mentioned, are kind of at least admiring of China's system. Some might look at North Korea, etc. Are you saying that, you know, as many things that are wrong with liberal democracy, it's still ultimately preferable to the hard authoritarianism of some of those regimes?
Yes, I am saying that. Because you even though there are the problems we've already mentioned, you know, the cash nexus, the oligarchy behind the shadows, there are still things that it cannot do to you easily. Right? You know, Xerxes could just haul a guy's son off, cut him in half, and march the army through because his satrap of daddy upset him. The president of the United States can't do that to you. There's still a trial by jury, right? There's still the court of law. Now, of course, you could declare an exception like during the war on terror, but I think that's still functionally different than, say, people getting arrested in North Korea. And then second of all, the other thing is you have, when you have a state that is completely, that is harder to influence, then reform becomes impossible. Now, one might argue, okay, well, it's too late now. Well, maybe, maybe not. But we do know that, you know, with a, like, now, granted, in the Soviet Union, the revolution that took it down was nonviolent. It was the Velvet Revolutions. But it becomes much, much harder to affect any sort of change in the government's position when you have a central state like that. And so it's like, yeah, both have problems. But I would argue that the Western tradition, of which this is a degraded form of, gives you more options than you would have under an authoritarian state.
The elite theorists, Mosca, Burnham, to some extent Juvenal as well, all say that the ideal state of things, from the point of view of freedom, this is, from the point of view of, you know, is actually where you do get rival elites who are genuinely jockeying for power. That Burnham has this little paper called Managing the Managers, where he says the ideal scenario is if you get, like, the managers are busy managing each other, and then us little people get to play in the cracks, that we get little glimpse of freedom in between while the elites are focused on each other. Now, obviously, this is, you know, from an idealist point of view, not ideal at all, because you don't want a system to be fractured. But what do you think of this idea in general from the elite theorists, that this is the best, like, you know, if you remember, the Machiavellians was called defenders of freedom. He was saying that they were the Machiavellian tradition is actually looking for freedom all the time. Yeah, what do you make of the idea?
Well, I mean, I think this idea has roots in the broader Western intellectual tradition. So the idea of competing, the three branches of government, the legislative, the executive, and the judicial, being then in competition with each other, that comes from, I can't think of his name now. There was a French political philosopher that influenced the founding fathers who also reproduced Montesquieu. Montesquieu. He makes a claims similar to that. And then the founding fathers do as well, that, you know, these are real interests, you know, with that are not necessarily the same, and they're meant to check each other. Polybius, when he writes about the Roman Republic, says the same thing. He says that the way the Roman state divided itself was such that in order, you know, each group had, for lack of a better word, sovereignty over certain aspects of the state apparatus. And to get the state to act in a coordinated fashion, they all had to agree. Not usually going to happen. In an emergency, that could be contravened by a dictator. But generally, you know, that's like Hannibal at the gates. So, you know, that's very extreme. We know what an emergency means in that context. You know, at peacetime, not so likely to see that in the Roman state. And then the idea then becomes these elements are in competition with each other. And so, yeah, I think that's a pretty good insight.
But I mean, looking at America, which branch, the judiciary, the House, the Senate, the executive, is not captured by Zionists?
Well,
it does seem to tend towards absolutism.
Well, I think I think the trend to absolutism, this ratchet that we're watching, is the centralization of wealth in the hands of a few. Because from the Great Rapprochement onward, the financial elites have been buying control over the media and the government, which in classical speak would have been a moral problem, because the Spartans and the early Romans prided themselves on not taking bribes, not getting paid money to look the other way. And they integrated that into a broader educational framework. But if you have an educational framework that doesn't breathe that into you, and then you have, you know, the compounding effect of, you know, the person that had money first gets more of it, so he has more power in the future to eventually buy all this out. We're just not dealing with these things as they are. What they were intended to be in the documents of the Constitution from the 18th century, they're not entirely not that, but they're a lot not that, because there's this pivot that's occurred behind the curtain that we didn't watch. And they then control things from behind, this financial oligarchy. And so I would argue that it's the Republic's decline has been more accurately described by left-wing critics than right-wing critics. Because right-wing critics will make a cultural argument, but not, I think, in the way that it's helpful. And they'll say this is just a natural outgrowth of these systems. Well, I mean, you know, Rome didn't have woke people. The Dutch Republic didn't have woke people. Greece, Switzerland, maybe now it does, but, you know, for most of its history, Venice, this is not the logical end state of Republican institutions. This is something else. We have a lot of history before techno-capital where we can observe these institutions. Athens would be a good comparison because it was an oligarchy that eventually took over. And then it happened in Rome too. And then oligarchy created Caesar. But then Caesar was like, yeah, no, I don't need you anymore. He went full Bane. I don't need you anymore. So he takes over. So that's what I'd say.
I mean, you've touched on another issue, though, because when I think of these quote-unquote authoritarian regimes, when you look into them, a lot of the stuff they do, I mean, Xi is a good example in China. Putin is a good example. Many, many other examples in Latin American history is basically like every leader since 1806 or something like that. But there are many other examples as well all around the world. If you actually look at what they fight, the phrase anti-corruption as a pretext for what the government is doing looms very large. And Xi's China is a good example. I mean, I think his anti-corruption campaign lasted a decade. Okay. Now, going back to what you were talking about with the problem with what's happened in America is that the American system's got corrupt. People have been the power of money and people have been bribery and so on to pay off people and, you know, to weaken the laws against such things, to, you know, allow everything to be corrupted by a small elite. This is what has happened in America. But then when you start to do something about it, you've already, like, the strength and force it takes to root it out then in itself tends towards what you would call authoritarianism. Like, is there any way to do it without looking to seize on. Todd.
Well, I mean, once you have a fully entrenched financial class, I mean, that's what happened in Rome. Caesar ended up taking over. But, I mean, if we look at, like, corruption, you know, as, you know, government inefficiencies or people looking the other way or taking bribes, again, let's look at history more broadly. I mean, the Roman, the Greek city-states were less corrupt than the Persian empire, because, and we can measure this because they won the war, right? The best way to determine corruption is where the stakes are so high, if you lose, you die. Because if the state can't mobilize its human and material resources effectively, it loses the war. And when it loses the war, you know, that's the end of the state. And, you know, these earlier examples that I've mentioned were much better able.
Hold on, though. I mean, I would say, again, as author of Prophets of Doom this time, I would say, well, yeah, but you're taking the Persians at the end of a 250-year cycle, right? If you look at the start of the 250-year cycle, it's the Persians who are not corrupt, taking corrupt, you know, whoever they were taking, the Babylonians or whoever they were smashing. And this is just like the cyclical nature of the cycles, whether you take the Tainter cycle or the Glub cycle. You know, an empire is vital for a time. It'll be non-corruptible for a time. And then it falls to corruption and decadence and various other problems. And then it ends up being taken by a more, you know, a less corrupt, more vital people down the line. This is arguably what happened with the first Persian Empire, and arguably then what ended up happening to every other empire that we can think of, and the ones before them. How would you come back on that?
Well, so all political states, you know, have this cycle, right? They go up and down, they rise and they fall. But there's two things, and we'll go back to Machiavelli because he talks about both. One is, for any given period of time, a republic is going to have a higher quality of leadership because of competition between elites. And he points to Sparta, Rome, and some of the Italian city-states. Holland wasn't a republic yet when he wrote. Second of all, the government is stable in that you don't have internal violent discord. So for example, the Western Roman Empire in the 5th century and the end of the Plantagenets in the 15th century, because power was absolute, it became a circular firing squad for anybody wearing the crown. And what happened in England was House Plantagenet killed itself off. You know, Henry Tudor was, you know, a cadet branch. He wasn't even, there was no way he was ever going to be king of England if it hadn't been for the War of the Roses. And so that lasted for 30 years. And then you had before that, in the early 12th century, the anarchy between Stephen and Matilda. We can't really conceptualize a political system so unstable that they're at war for 20, 30 years at a time. Republics were praised because they avoided that. Sparta broadly avoided that. Rome broadly avoided that until the oligarchs took over. Switzerland has avoided that. I would say that the U.S. Civil War is not a internal. It's not the same as like the War of the Roses, because the South wasn't fighting to control the U.S. federal government like the House, like the White and the Red Rose were trying to control the same crown. Right, one is a secession crisis rather than a competition for struggle, and so you have these circular firing squads where all of these autocrats just keep killing each other in order to get to the top, and then that completely eliminates the leadership class. It's gone. This happens in China, you know, historically. And so a lot of these regimes just self-delete because, well, if the guy with all the power doesn't like you, you're probably dead. So you want to be the guy with all the power. And so now you have this, the elites can't trust each other and they start killing each other off. Whereas if you have some sort of already defined and declared elite competition with limits on what the winner can do, you can avoid the troubles. You can avoid, not the troubles, the War of the Roses. You can avoid, you know, the brutal civil wars between Roman emperors.
Very interesting, Todd. You know, it's funny. I talk about exactly this in the intro to this book. I'm not trying to shill it. It's just this exact topic But my explanation of what happens there is a little bit different. Yes, you're right. You get the circular firing squad, and you know, the Orcs versus the Lancasters and so on. But what was actually happening was the you could argue that it was a degeneration. Okay. In this case, our Syra, if you want to take it back to the Mackie, you start off with a wise king and you end up with shitheads, right? In this case, the wise king was William the Conqueror, William the Bastard. Okay. I know there are some people who will watch this who are so kind of English nationalist that they don't like William the First because he killed, obviously he conquered the country and killed lots of people, right? But objectively speaking, he put in place a very robust set of administrative tools and parallel institutions. You know, he kept the shire system, there was the parish system, there was the feudal baronies, okay? And this whole thing that he put in place was chivalric. It was an honor system with little carve-outs, little special carve-outs for cities, for commercial activity and commerce, okay? Over time, that feudal system that William set up degenerated and became corrupted, you could argue, with money, cash money. Okay, cash payment, as Carlyle would say. And so by the time you get to the War of the Roses, the old feudal bonds that were meant to be kept in place through oaths, blood oaths, I pledge vassalage to you as my liege, etc., had been replaced with a mercenary cash payment army. And rents, which were used to be paid in the form of turnips or whatever. Now a lot of the actual estates were paying cash rents. Okay, so I guess what I'm saying is, even in that case, that you could say, well, this is the problem with feudalism that will always happen. Okay, you could argue that. Well, I guess what I'm saying is that this is like an Evolian explanation, I guess. Is that you've got a degeneration of an aristocratic martial caste who gave in to commerce or who became corrupted with commerce, which resulted in the selfish dog-eat-dog world of the War of the Roses. Then the Tudors managed to kind of have an absolute monarchy for a while. But it was only for a while, and then you got an actual civil war. And ultimately, the merchant caste ended up creating what we know now. So this is just a slightly different way of looking at it. I guess what I'm saying is, you could argue that this is not a problem with monarchy per se, but with some of the specific things that happened to feudalism as set up by William the First. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I mean, I do, but I would say that the anarchy took place 50 years after William died. I mean, they were at each other's throats for 20 years. Now, eventually, there was a modus vivendi, and the English ruling class and the Plantagenets, were able to maintain some sort of balance. But then it all just went off the skids with the War of the Roses. But let's use another example. The Dominate of the Roman Empire, right? You have the Barracks Emperors, which come to power with Septimus Severus. Okay, now we know who's in charge. It's not money, it's the legions, because they play kingmaker. So now we're back to hard power of the state, not some woo-woo mystical money behind the scenes. Well, that just creates this endless circular firing squad where the Caesars just keep killing each other, raising armies to fight each other. And that's ultimately what brings down the West. And over time, I think also the East. Because when you have, for example, the great defeat at Manzikert occurred because one of the generals left and marched on Constantinople to claim the throne, starting the civil war. And because of that, all of Asia Minor falls to the Turks. That's a level of political instability that you don't see with Sparta, Athens, Rome, Venice, Holland. Like, that's ridiculous.
Interesting. All right. Well, so you're defending the Republic as an institution at a time where Yavin's going on TV arguing for absolute monarchy. You're saying actually the Republic, don't count the Republic out yet, Todd.
Yes, exactly. Don't count the Republic out yet.
A lot of things to think about. I'm still kind of skeptical as to whether the names that you give these things end up mattering that much. Myself, although I will say, if you were given the choice of living in the liberal democracy or living in like the North Korea, we would all go for the liberal democracy every time, right? But then I wonder, is that just because I'm a child of it? Is that because that is what I have known? And then it's like, well, okay, what other things come with the liberal democracy? And what I guess what you're saying is a lot of the modern ills that lots of, me included, lots of people have looked at and said, well, this is the result of liberal democracy, woke, and all of these kind of modern maladies. You're saying there's a different reason for them, and that actually we don't need to throw the baby out with the bathwater. There's something worth preserving in the idea of a mixed semi-representative government.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
And just to wrap up with this point is we have looked at history. We have from ancient Greeks down. None of the ancient, medieval, or early modern republics ended this way. So clearly whatever's happening now was not an active force back then. And I think that's because technology is the active force. The reign of the money and the cash nexus. They create a whole new set of dynamics and conditions and factors that radically alter and distort these processes, such that we, looking at them now, are going to draw conclusions that are contingent by our unique place in history, rather than what is the legacy of observed republics throughout the history of Europe up until, say, the French Revolution.
Well, interesting. Whenever we get into historical waters, I'm always a little bit tentative because history nerds have a habit of writing massive essays. So I'm expecting this video to have lots of massive essays in the comments. I look forward to it. It'd be like, that thing you said in 1217, it wasn't quite right, Todd. Actually, it went down like this, et cetera, et cetera. But that's all fun and games. Speaking of history, like I said, Foundations of Shakespeare, pick it up. 25% off with ShoreJan. Where can people find your stuff, Todd?
Well, you can find my channel on YouTube at the Praise of Folly Podcast. And you can follow me on Twitter at POF Podcast.
See you soon.
Bye-bye.
If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the Academic Agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just 3 of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.